It's one of the most extreme places beyond imagination, really. King Island, not far from the Diomedes. Somehow people lived there for centuries, culturally tightly linked to a severe natural environment. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Time to go back there? Well, Joan Kane is going. Our toll-free number to talk with Joan Kane is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Poet Joan Kane here to talk with us on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The University of Alaska Southeast has web-based bachelor degree programs for first-time and transfer students. Learn online and work closely with advisors and experts in subjects like history, psychology, and anthropology. Cutting-edge technology prepares students for a variety of career paths, including graduate programs in teaching, counseling, and law. For more information, call Gail Klein at 228-4508. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
And Lord knows what they'll say. Well, smiling at me from the other side of the console is Joan Kane. She knows me from listening to me on the radio. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Joan.
Thank you, Steve. It's a real honor and privilege to be here.
Well, I think the honor is ours. Your honors have been stacking up lately.
Well, my kids make sure that I stay out of trouble, so.
Well, I'm wondering about that, actually, just to start with. How do you do that when you got kids? How do you manage to get the writing done, especially poetry is such a delicate thing?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be able to do anything without my family. My husband's a superstar dad, and then I also...
You have a day job, too.
I do. I'm guilty of having a day job.
Yeah.
But I also, in the King Island tradition, you know, I have many cousins and family members who have helped me, with my children and given them love and support in the old King Island way, when it was a big belief of ours to help build children up, give them the tools that they would need to cope and try to get along with other people and, you know, keep their senses together. And I tell you, my five-year-old, I came home from Nome and he had a whole to-do list that he made for me out of staples. He had these little to-do lists and he stapled them all together. His to-do list was about this big and it was blank. And he said, "There you go, Mommy. Now you can start writing down all the things you need to do."
Oh, God, that's beautiful.
He's very helpful.
You know, this kind of brings us around. I want to talk about your honors a little bit, but first, it does bring me around to this subject of King Island very beautifully. And you talk about the King Island Way. And it's so odd because nobody's lived there since, 1962 or so? and yet everybody remembers it. And I mean, you weren't even born in 1962. What is it? Why is it such a distinct memory for King Island people? I mean, I know like seven or eight of them, and they're all the same way.
Well, I mean, I think once, even the physical place has been in many ways inaccessible to us. What is still accessible to us is our language, our culture, our families, our dances. The King Island dancers and drummers are, you know, some people say we have the best Yurok, we've managed to keep our traditions alive and keep that part of our identity because, you know, when everything else gets taken away, I think what remains for individuals and what remains for a collective community is each other. And I mean, that's how Inupiaq people, that we define ourselves through our relationships and our kin relationships. And I'm very fortunate that that those relationships exist and are real for me, you know, who my children are named after, who I am named after, how I situate and contextualize myself by who my family members are, by who my cousins are, and who my children's relations are as well.
So how's all the book learning from Harvard and so forth layer onto all that?
Well, you know, I was fortunate. I think, you know, the nice thing about Harvard is that they don't let people drop out of school there. And that was one of the big reasons of Well, except for like Bill Gates, for example, or or Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg. They don't let people drop out. And they actually, it was real hard. And it was, I was very homesick. But at the same time, there is a small group of native students there. Fisherman, Sven Hawkinson Jr. was kind of my big brother when I was there as an undergraduate.
Ah.
He was there at the same time.
Oh, cool.
Yep. So, you know, I think... All my life, I heard go get an education, and I'm very fortunate that Harvard is where I was able to go, because I think I did get a pretty good amount of book learning in, but also got to see a bit of the wider world. I mean, you cross paths with every kind at Harvard, and you can learn a lot of things. And I think that's what college is about when you're, you know, in your early 20s and trying to figure out what's next.
And then you went on to a master's.
I did, but as you know, I did a stint. I did a year here in Anchorage for Kwanic, for National Native News, Native America Calling, and then got myself back to the East Coast after that year.
Mm-hmm. But, so along with everything else, you're a broadcaster.
Well, and... I wouldn't go that far.
Now you are. You are, and now you're going to be... actually an MFA teacher in Santa Fe.
Yes. And
so you're going to Santa Fe. It's basically going to be a school year. Is that how it works?
No, the amazing thing about this program, and it is a brand new program, they'll start the first cohort of students this summer, along with faculty like Sherman Alexi, Sherwin Bitsui, Orlando White, Santi Frazier, Melissa Fables, Natalie Diaz, John Davis, of course.
You're totally blowing my mind here. This is a galaxy of superstars.
They are superstars.
Yeah.
I don't know how
and
I got.
You. And you.
And then there's me. But, you know, for a lot of my friends that write now, and create art now came out of IAIA, and a lot of my mentors, too, Joy Harjo, for instance.
Yeah.
And I feel real fortunate that they started this low residency MFA program. So I'll be down there a couple of weeks a year, but mostly working with students. You know, the reality is if you're a native artist, native writer, scratch that. If you're any kind of artist or writer, you've got to have a day job as well. You know, it's a real luxury to take years out of your life to go get an MFA. What this permits is for people to do the things that they need to do in their daily lives, whether it's their families and their jobs or whatever else, attend to that, but take a couple weeks a year to have intensive residencies. So I'll be on faculty at the Institute of American Indian Arts in 2014. And I think Sherman and a couple of other folks are kicking it off this summer, but I'll be in round two. So.
And how, I mean, there's people do so much by internet nowadays. Do you actually, I mean, you know, given my choice between Anchorage and Santa Fe, I think Santa Fe would win.
Well, maybe that's because you're not an Eskimo.
Yeah.
Unless there's something about you, I don't know. No, Santa Fe is a wonderful place. You know, it's just that my children are here, my husband's here, my family is here. And I think, you know, I'm fortunate that I'll be able, it's easy now. I can get on a couple planes and get to Santa Fe in about 15 hours. You know, it's not
it
like.
It seems like you're kind of used to this. I guess you have to fly around quite a lot already.
I do, and that's actually, you asked earlier how the poems fit in, and some of the, I mean, I was trained to write poems. I did go to poetry school, and so I can write poems sort of in the cracks and in the spaces. You know, I don't have a TV, so I think when I would really like to veg out and watch Downton Abbey or something, I can sit down and write a poem instead. But the airplanes are actually really helpful because they're some of the few times that I get to read and write, and you know, I'm essentially trapped there with nothing else to do.
It's an odd consciousness. I like that consciousness too. I mean, just the artist in me is called forth in airports and on aircraft, just because I guess it's so alien. It's as, you might as well have gone into space somehow.
Yeah, I think there's probably, if there isn't an anthology of poems written on airplanes or boats or in travel, you know, there ought to be. I mean, I know Frank O'Hara, a lot of his energy came from, again, being, for instance, in the city or having this certain anonymity or this feeling of being in motion constantly between occupations or preoccupations.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about the King Island Project, because that's why I asked you to be here. But it's fun getting to know you. Before we start on it, perhaps you could find me a poem, because I really think that the radio medium and poetry are made for each other. And every once in a while, we get to do a poetry show. As a matter of fact, we almost did a poetry show this year. Most years, we do a poetry show. This year, we almost did one, but it kept misfiring because I couldn't get people wrangled together. And you were one of the people that I almost could have got wrangled together. So you're here now, and you got your poems, and you're a poet. You're nationally recognized, internationally recognized native poet. And let's hear one.
Okay. is it all right if I go for one of my longer ones, or is that going to lose people?
No, I don't think, I think whatever you do right now, you can't lose anybody.
Okay. I'll give a little backstory for this, if that's all right.
That's a good idea.
William O'Quillick wrote a book called The People of Kuwerik. Now, my grandfather's family is from King Island. My grandmother's family is from Mary's Igloo by way of Shishmaref. And of course, all of Mary's Igloo was just decimated in the 1918 flu epidemic. And that was one of the disasters that William O'Quillick wrote about. He was also orphaned in the epidemic as well. And this entire generation was raised at Pilgrim Hot Springs out there off the Cougar Rock Road. And my grandmother and her sisters were part of that. They walked along the frozen Kuzitrine and Pilgrim Rivers from Mary's Igloo. I mean, literally, there were so many dead adults that flu killed people in the very prime of their life. It spared the very young and it spared the very old. And this poem references it in some way, but the poem is called Legend, and it's because in the Kuwerik tradition, there are five disasters that Kuwerik people have lived through. The first was an earthquake and a flood. The second, the first was an earthquake and an eclipse. The second was a flood. The third was a time of great famine and a year of two winters. And the fourth was a flu epidemic. And William O'Quillick wrote about the fifth disaster, which at the time his manuscript was published originally in 1971. He said, the fifth disaster is maybe happening now when we begin to lose our relationships to each other. We begin to lose our identity. We begin to lose our language. We begin to lose our way of life. And, I think each disaster before this has had an end in the tradition of the Kuwerik people. And, you know, I would like to do whatever small part I can to help end the fifth disaster. And a lot of what I write is an enactment of that ending and a reclamation of where we can go after this fifth disaster is over. So this poem was in four parts. It's called Legend. And again, it references the four disasters that he wrote about. So Legend 1. I would have been a girl bound in stone, quartz coarse, cracked, and whitening as bone. Os echoing away from twin calderas, but for a long string which drew me to the sea. A 16-strand sinnet lane on sand marks the rivers unbraiding, knotted, and plaiting their skeins toward the basin, where a red-throated loon shot through the eye yields his largest rib for an awl. At our junction, a bunch of feathers. I take a brittle weed and leaf, thumb chert, blade gray. Our junction, a fumarole. When it smokes, I lose sight of the girl. It is nothing to know the rift and buckle, to witness the sun eclipse for days on end, the bruised fields redden and freeze. 2. The sea, then, our garden, a film char of oil on water, a hiss of tides run up to that which was burning and has gone out, a slow erosion. It is one thing to give oneself to water, I wore down to a spur of myself. A bird with nowhere to land alighted on a femur, a terrible need. The land took a drink of the sea, mountain valleys soft as throats. She knew of submerged peaks recollected in an unheard song, seized in a lesser fever. The induced shore keeps still a drowned order. 3. Meant to have gone to famine in a season recurring from wind, it would not turn. Into a deep snow and sleep, I shook again. If she could not beat the lightness from her clothes, it would become a layer that eddied around in mouth, myriad and everywhere. No animal stirs in the noiseless quick of a year of two winters, but marrow, gristle of a bloated fish, roots split and cached, skin torn from the hull of a boat, long withdrawn from water. 4. Hers, a burial in damp sand by the springs. Through December, willows green there, alder bark reddens against late snow. Those dead, too numerous, no loose entombments beneath scars of rock. Nothing roots in the oldest graves, lichen lifts with a fingernail scrape. Leave belongings piled, the opaque white bead now unstrung, the unidentified fragment, ivory ferrule, the small human figure carved of wood.
You don't do part 5, huh?
Well, like I said, I think of the rest of my poems, hopefully enact part 5.
Oh.
But I won't read you all 3 books of those right now.
Well, you know, you're working a bunch of metaphors in there. King Island's got to be kind of a metaphor.
It is, and sort of one of the other sort of pretext or context I like to give for this poem is that, of course, in our tradition, you are named for someone who has passed away before you are born. And so the her, the persona of this poem, the she, it was a way for me to pay tribute to this long line of female ancestors, my namesakes, that survived not just these disasters, but, you know, extremely difficult, you know, life conditions. And in a way, by taking on this persona of my namesake in this poem, I'm trying to pay respect towards all the things that our women had to do to survive and raise their families and keep the population up and keep our teachings and traditions up in order for us to survive.
So that's Novayuk?
Mm-hmm.
Novayuk. And so that name, that it simply carries on. I mean, there was a Novayuk before you and one before her and so forth, probably women each time. And
sometimes women, sometimes men, actually.
Really?
Yeah, but it depends. It doesn't have to go along with gender, but for the past couple of generations, yes, it's been women.
So the King Island society is intact enough culturally that all the observances with regards to cousins and their roles and all that is still played out.
Yes, absolutely. And my children.
That's fascinating.
And my children and their Eskimo names. I mean, it's not just that we have a King Island name, each of us. Well, I only have a King Island name, but my older son, he's got several names. He's got one from Little Diomede, Kazuglana, that's shared by a number of, we call them Avazaks, people who share your name. And when I go to Nome, as I was in Nome just this last week, I got to see a couple of other Kazuglanas of different generations. But he was named for my late uncle, John Kukuluk Jr. We definitely are intact. We definitely honor as well. My son's also got a Kwerek name because my grandmother was a choir mute person. And so his Kwerek name is Atkaduak, which is shared by Percy Nyakpuk's late wife, my good friend Gwen Nyakpuk's mother, Gwen, Sophie, and Sheila, and Tom, their late mother, Inez Nyakpuk. So it's how we still maintain a lot of our ties, not just within the King Island community, but with others outside of the King Island community. King Islanders, like all the people of Northwest Alaska, were, you know, built their alliances and built enormous economies and trade economies and cultural economies through these kin relationships.
How long ago was that Year of Two Winters?
The Year of Two Winters, people say, I mean, if you go back and kind of compare and contrast, I think they believe it was a year there was a huge explosion, volcanic explosion.
It was Katmai then.
It must have been Katmai. And
yes,
it was
when? In 1917, I think.
Yeah. So, but of course, you know.
No, before that, 1907?
Yeah, 1907 is more like it because there was, it was intervals, you know, before.
Right.
But then too, people say it also could have been when Krakatoa erupted.
Oh.
I mean, because of course, you know, these disasters are, they are archetypal, you know, and they don't, you know, they don't just refer to one incident, I believe. Certainly there were years of famine, and certainly there were years of, years of eclipses and earthquakes and things like that.
So tell me this, and I want you to be looking for another poem too, but not to decide on it yet. I think there were four catastrophes or catastrophes? Is that a good
disasters, word? Catastrophe.
Yeah. And the fifth one, which doesn't seem to have an end, you would like to help bring an end and try to reach towards where we can go. So how does King Island fit into where we can go?
Well, I mean, it fits into where we can go because for generations there have been King Islanders that haven't been back and haven't been able to just simply go back to the island and even have a visual and physical understanding of the extreme conditions that our people, you know, lived in for, you know, hundreds of thousands or, you know, the big thing they say is 10,000 years, but for thousands of years in any case. So I think understanding the source of our culture and the source of our identity, what shaped us, what allowed us to exist into this modern context is a central part of it. I also think that, you know, and I have lots of ideas and lots of plans, and I'm not going to get to all of them this summer or even next summer, but, you know, I've talked with people in the Bering Straits region quite a bit, and there are ideas that we can go, and Jana Harcharak does it on the North Slope, where they do camps that are focused on sort of my generation, this childbearing generation now, and our children, and just getting us back to have some connection with each other and to the land, is a very important part of it. So I think that, I think part of ending the fifth disaster is being able to come together, being able to recognize that there's, in our lifetimes, I've been fortunate. I mean, the generation before mine, my mother, they're the ones that were forcibly relocated. They're the ones that had to learn English, that had to go to boarding school. They're the ones who 40 years ago were dealing with the Settlement Act. My generation has been very fortunate to, you know, we've witnessed a lot of this trauma, but we didn't experience it necessarily firsthand. And I think our parents have done well, our elders have done well in equipping us to begin to work together and begin to envision a different kind of outcome for us that, that our life doesn't begin and end in a cubicle and that it's time for us to start thinking more largely about how we want to be self-determined and how we want to continue carrying forth the things that are going to help our families become nourished and grow, help raise healthy children, help have good relationships again.
King Island is sort of the ends of the earth.
Or the beginning of the earth, depending.
Well, literally kind of the ends of the earth because it's right next to the international dateline, among other things. But it's hard to imagine humans being able to exist, survive, and reproduce in an environment much more severe than that. It's about as severe as it can get. And then, so it takes a lot to deal with that environment. And you look at the pictures of that old village on stilts, and you think, how could people possibly have chosen to live there? But they did. And there's reasons, as you look, there's reasons, the abundance of the marine mammals, the things that could only be done there or could better be done there. There's reasons, but returning?
And returning.
I mean, returning to get in touch with it, maybe, but literally returning to try and inhabit?
Well, and that's beyond the scope of what I hope to accomplish this summer and next summer. But, you know, I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't discount anything as a possibility.
Really?
It is a tremendous place. I hope to have a greater understanding of it once I go there. I mean, everyone says that the real hunters, the King Island men, and, you know, my grandfather lived an entirely subsistence lifestyle, didn't speak a word of English, not a word. And My cousins who are there continuing this tradition, my uncles, you know, the men who know how to hunt on the moving sea ice, that's a tremendous body of knowledge. And the women that know how to, you know, prepare all those subsistence foods, not just for food and sustenance, but also for shelter, for warmth, for clothing. I mean, you know, that is a tremendous accomplishment. And, you know, I think, you know, we've in particularly in the Bering Straits region, there have been all sorts of proposals to relocate Shishmaref here or there, or you go a little bit further north, Kivalina. We're beginning to see all these, you know, generations of displacement and replacement and trying to build subdivisions in rural Alaska or what have you. I think it's a good time to just, consider a lot of the options and inform ourselves about how, you know, what is sustainable, what was sustainable, what can we do to begin to understand where we are now. And hopefully that's not too open-ended, but I mean, that's certainly a preoccupation of mine.
The one you didn't mention was Nutak.
Well, I mentioned the subdivision.
And the Nutak situation is basically that's Nelson Island. That is one of the places the manifest destiny least reached, left the culture more or less intact. I mean, there's more of it surviving there than in most of Alaska. But the village is still being eaten up by the river, or actually it's the ocean, but it would seem like the river if you were living there, and so they made the choice to put it someplace higher up and pretty kind of far away, really, and it's been difficult. The Shishmaref thing, you can understand different people feel different ways, and it's complicated by, well, maybe more could be done about the erosion and how fast will it be and on like that. And where do you go when you're on a spit? Same with Kivalina. Kivalina, as I understand it, is like, this is in some ways the best place you could possibly want to live in the world. This is where everything is right there. Unfortunately, it's getting flooded.
Yeah.
You know, these are, when you get close to them, these are not simple things at all.
No,
this is not a matter of it. Okay, well, we'll just build a new one over there.
No, and you know, and it was never simple either before this era of, you know, needing schools and washaterias and, oh, maybe water and sewer if they get on the right VSW list. I won't go there.
That's all right. You can go there.
That's my other former day jobs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think our people have been contending with, you know, our people were essentially people that could move and did move. They followed resources. This is not to say that they were completely nomadic people, but, you know, Inupiaq people follow opportunity and adapt. Consider some of the technology even that my grandfather developed in his lifetime. I mean, it's tremendous. It's tremendous what people, when you really begin to know places, how you begin to adapt. You know, it would be pretty unheard of to go back and inhabit the same sod hut, you know, year after year, all seasons. I mean, that never existed. People were on the move. That, you know, King Island was traditionally inhabited in the winter, and King Islanders would go to the mainland or go see our relatives in Wales, our Diomede, Wainwright, Barrow, you know, all over the place. Gamble, Savunga. I mean, King Islanders didn't just stay in one place in the summertime. So
this is so different from the primitives I thought I knew about when I was a kid. In the 1950s, it was all seemed so simple. You know, the whole world was going to get civilized.
Right.
You know, this is right around the same time the last person is leaving King Island. Right.
I think my grandfather was on, along with the other King Island dancers, was on the Ed Sullivan Show in New York City in 1964. So
yeah, their dancing got really famous really early.
Yep.
And it's still famous.
It is.
So do you dance?
You know, I try to learn. As you may have observed me over the years, I'm a pretty uncoordinated nerd. I try to learn. My little boys, every opportunity that I get to show them real Eskimo dancing, I bring them. I play for them a lot of the songs at home. One of my...
Do you have dance fans?
We're not Yupik, Steve.
There's no dance fans?
There's no dance fans for King Island Women.
Oh.
So my little boy...
We got something like that?
Well, there's the ceremonial masks and regalia.
There's
the wolf dance mitts, but little boys are too... They don't have enough. They're still observing. They're 3 and 5, you know, so they are still observing. It's their job now to watch and get excited about what they see their older cousins and uncles and relatives do. And that's the first way of letting them learn, is to see how important these dances are and a lot of the meanings of these dances aren't immediately apparent in the songs. My kids, I do my best to give them inupiatun, but, you know, I do my best, but they're still learning.
I better take the break because this take a long time.
Okay.
It's Talk of Alaska. Joan Kane is with us. She's the author of The Cormorant Hunter's Wife, Hyperboreal, and Now When the World Was Milk?
Milk, yes.
When the World Was Milk. Was that the first one?
That's the third one. That's the most recent one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And she has recently, and we haven't even spoken about it directly, she's recently managed to go through crowdsourcing to finance an expedition back to King Island, where her people came from. But have you probably flown over it, yes?
I've flown by it. I've seen it. In fact, just this last week when I was traveling through Kotzebue to Nome, I was sitting next to my good partner cousin, Giminak, Maddie Alvana Stimple, and we were so excited. We could see King Island. We were taking iPhone photos out the window, and it was just looked so beautiful. But I've never been closer than that.
You're going to touch it.
God willing.
God willing. there's ways of getting there, but flying isn't one of them.
Helicopter is.
Right. Fix wing. Sorry. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. provimaging.com.
It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255. You're more than welcome to join our conversation with Joan Kane, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call of 550-8422. And our email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And from email, I discover that this is what's so handy about modern communications. Nova Rupta blew in 1912, the year of two winters. And joining us by telephone from the Kuskokwim River is Morgan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Morgan.
Yeah, I'm from the Kuskokwim of Part Yupik, and I was going to find it interesting, that story of two winters. You know, it was told by us, our ancestors, too, probably caused by volcanic eruption or something. And you mentioned that the fifth disaster we might be facing, you know, is... attacking or losing our culture. But I remember one of the stories was told people were so hungry or starving, they crushed one fish egg in a pot of water, and they all ate from it, and they called it soup. That's how hungry people were. And you mentioned not losing our culture. And one thing, our Native corporations, you know, sometimes I wonder why, after 1971, our kids are not considered native shareholders. It seems like that shouldn't be dividing us, and I hate to see that happen. That should be changed. That's but one thing. A few corporations allow that, but that's one thing we need to watch for. One story, my Auntie Sam, she said people would get worse and worse, like, you know, and I was at a meeting, and I noticed the way how things have changed, how a lot of the young girls dress, you know, just almost exposing them. So I said, where's the parents or grandparents to tell them, hey, don't do that? And they wonder why there's so many pregnancies out of marriage, you know. You know, that flood, even though Native people didn't hear about the gospel, you know, we knew that there was another being, and we know about the flood, and but there's a, as believers, we know there's another ark coming for us, and as believers, we, you know, we couldn't be saved, but it, next time it's going to be destroyed by fire. So, you know, those are my comments, and I agree we need to preserve our culture. And one more thing, you know, we're saying we're facing the salmon crisis, you know, and the Lord says if we ask in His name, you know, He'll help us. And I said we need to do praying, you know. We sure need it. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Morgan. So there you have from a view from the Kuskokwim River, Joan. I think, as I recall, the Catholics got King Island.
They did. When they all sat down and divided up the map of the state of Alaska, King Island went to the Catholics.
And you know, there's quite a to-do about this statue of Jesus they put up there.
Christ the King.
Yeah, he's still there.
So I'm told.
Made of bronze.
So I am told.
So how do you face that? How do you deal? I mean, you must have been raised Catholic. Maybe you're not so Catholic anymore, but how do you, spirituality and belief and culture and all that, how do you blend all that together?
Well, that's
you're gonna pray for salmon?
This is a very tricky question.
Yeah.
I mean, that poem actually that I read, I have discussed this with very few people before, but here I go. I was actually living in New York at the time that I wrote that poem, and I had moved to New York about 3 weeks before 9/11. And I think this was the summer of the blackouts that I wrote, you know, the rolling blackouts in New York City, which if it happened any time before 9/11, who knows, you know, what could have happened. But the city was orderly, you know, it was peaceful. But it was that summer. And I was at this point in my writing where I felt like, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. I get to go back to Nome every summer, but I feel so far from who I really believe I am. And I actually asked for guidance from my ancestors. I asked for guidance from my grandmother and grandfather. I asked for help. I said, I don't know what to write. And that poem came out of it. And, you know, Yeats talks about automatic writing. And I always thought that was, you know, a bit of one of these poetic riffs. But, you know, I think that there's a tremendous strength that we have when we stop to ask and we stop to seek guidance. And, you know, I'm not saying it was an automatic writing. I wrote every single word there. I labored over my OED and, you know, my Birds of the Seward Peninsula and whatnot. But I you know, labored over William O'Quillick's notes in his book. But I definitely think that in our tradition and in all human traditions, part, you know, you can't do anything alone. In fact, there's a big, big, big part of most Native cultures, most human cultures that succeed is asking for help, you know, and I think that's really at the heart of overcoming a lot of challenges is once you're able to identify what you need help with, it really helps. You know, it really allows you to become, you know, self-determined and empowered. So I think that's certainly part of it. There's another comment that he had about shareholders, you know, people born after 1971. I'm an afterborn. There's no doubt I'd rather have my grandparents than shares, but so be it. I'm a shareholder of three different corporations. And I think it's something that 40 years after the Settlement Act, I think there are a lot of really good questions that can be raised. I think there's a lot of due props and due respect to the people that were involved with the Settlement Act. But I think, you know, like I said, maybe our generation's ready to begin looking at the sort of tertiary set of questions and answers that maybe we need to begin to come together and confront. So I really enjoyed his comments.
Well, it's, I mean, looking at it from my perspective of a part of the colonial power, it was assimilationist. It seems obvious to me that the intent of the Claims Act was not just to settle the claims, but to start an assimilationist process. And that, I'm not sure that's culturally appropriate.
Well, and actually it was with the Settlement Act that we moved from an era of official federal policy of assimilation to the official federal policy of self-determination.
Good point.
So I think there's something there. I mean, certainly it was a transitional time, and now again we're reassessing self-determination. I think a lot of us that have relationships with our village corporations and understand the distinctions between our village corporations and our tribal councils, if we are so lucky to be tribally enrolled or tribally recognized outside of our corporations, I think we're at the point now where we can begin to see things a little more clearly, to understand, well, we've had 40 years from a lot of the original incorporation of our village corporations. Let's develop a better sense of the work that still remains to be done. And
well, if we try and do a show on this, maybe you, if you're not in Santa Fe or and then whatever you're doing, your busy schedule in Nome or getting to King Island again, maybe you can come in and join us on the show where we would discuss. Would you be willing to do that?
Of course. And, you know, even if I weren't here, I'd be listening to it on the radio.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's the great thing about this show. Joan Kane is our guest, and our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, just to remind you, statewide, and toll-free, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. It's okay to just give a shout-out and say, hey, I'm one of your people. I got on that crowdsourcing. You can thank me in part for that, because that was something. Did you know that you were, did you have any idea, I mean, okay, you get an idea, you put it together, and you send the pitch out there on the internet. and it's okay if I get $30,000. Now you're well over that.
Yeah, I had no idea, and there are hundreds of people who have shown their support.
So tell me what the actual pitch is. What are you going to do with this money?
Well, the pitch was just that I would be able to finally go to King Island and bring a small group with me.
Some relatives.
Well, relatives and others. I mean, mm-hmm. we're all related on King Island. but relatives and other people that would able, you know, that have been there before, others like in my generation, even the generation before mine that were King Islanders, that just never had a chance to go. My pitch was simply that this, you know, throughout now, I guess, you know, I'm considered mid-career in my writing career. And at this point, I mean, I've always wanted to go to King Island. I've always felt that that was the missing piece of my identity, was actually going there. I mean, I've stood on the Teller Road. I've climbed Singatuk, you know, behind Cape Woolley. I've looked at King Island. I've flown past it. I've heard about it from my earliest childhood. And I thought, well, I mean, I just need to go there. And I've known that for a long time. And there have been other projects that have gone, projects with really ambitious goals, projects to document plans, to document place names. There have been projects that have been funded by the National Science Foundation, projects that, like, Alice Rogoff did, and she, I guess, placed everything on the National Register of Historic Places. But my project was simply to go with people that wanted to go and that could help out, and people whose vision was that, okay, so it took a lot to get us to go this time, but next time it's not going to be so hard. And the time after that, maybe it won't be so hard. And maybe sometime we'll be able to have our, you know, King Island, I'm on the board of directors of King Island Native Corporation. Maybe we'll be able to have a meeting out there. You know, maybe we can go back. We can start this process of finding out how to get as many people as want to go back for whatever duration they want to go back for. But this trip, its initial ambitions were pretty small. You know, I'm a writer. I'm going to write another book of poetry. It appears that I have this impulse to keep writing them. I'm also working on a novel. And, you know, people get Guggenheims and all sorts of grants to go all over the world and Fulbrights, whatever. The only place I've ever really wanted to go was back to King Island.
So, there it is.
Yeah. So I was blown away and truly supportive of all generosity of all the donors. Some of my best teachers, you know, all throughout my, you know, education here in Anchorage, but certainly in college. And
some of us just want to see the result, you know. I'll throw a little money. I want to see what she does with it.
Well, I joked with my husband when we were at 50%. I thought, well, maybe that's all the people that want to send me to King Island and keep me there. I can joke like that with my husband.
How far along are you now that you know you have the resources to do it? You actually have to do it. Can you manage to get it, pull it all together in another month or so?
Yes, I think so. And a lot of what I'm hearing now from elders and from other people is that perhaps the desire to go in the later half of July for a week or two is too long, that the weather gets too bad. And thankfully, with all the generosity and all the support, I know for certain that I will be able to get there, that maybe a week or 5 days is more manageable for this trip. And again, my goals are not to do any sort of reconnaissance or bring objects back or, you know, go digging around or disturb anything, erect shelters or, you know, do anything other than just be there. So, you know, I will have funding left over for next summer as well. And I think that's the other thing is, you know, I have cousins that have gone, relatives, aunts and uncles, many people, and they say maybe this time I just need to go and see what I can do next.
Also, like you say, there's a seasonal reality that you're becoming aware of through the elders and you know, people with the experience. I'm sure there's things about the currents and so forth. I mean, maybe you don't have to use a helicopter. Maybe it's possible to, you know, get there by boat somehow.
Yep. And I have there's a great guy with a crab tender. He just showed me his little dinghy that he got. There's ways to go there by boat as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. How many miles is it?
Well, it's 90 miles from Nome, but it's about 40 miles from Cape Woolley or Cape Rodney.
Uh-huh. And can you anchor a boat there at the Cape? No.
Yeah. At the Cape, you can.
Yeah, you can.
You can. And then you can get close into King Island and then take smaller crafts right up to the boulders at the base of the island.
Yeah, because that was one of the deals where there was a navigation difficulty. You can't really have much of a draft and get, yeah.
You certainly can't. I mean, wow. It's not an easy place to get to. And I think
probably the charts aren't all that great either about, you know, where those rocks are and everything.
No, and you know, and I guess this is a little bit off topic, but you know, I was in Barrow in March and there was open seawater and you know, it was terrifying to see.
I know. I've talked to people. In fact, we did a show while that was happening.
Yeah, and it's just
very scary.
There are things going on with the climate and environment that, you know, it could be, I mean, it's always a highly unpredictable place. It's in the middle of the Bering Sea. So of course I am humbled by, you know, that which I do not control, which is basically everything. But especially the weather, and especially, you know, especially Mother Nature.
Okay, Joan Kane's our guest at Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Project Schmoject, she just wants to go. Joan Kane is with us, and her project is to go to King Island. And she's gotten enough money through crowdsourcing that she can do it, and she's going to do it. She's telling us why, and it's a fascinating conversation. Karen, by email, Joan says you were talking about the way names are passed on, and something caught her attention. She wanted you to get that word back from you again because she didn't get it written down. What is the word that means shared name with other relatives?
Avazak.
Avazak. Can you give me a spelling?
I can try.
So good.
Avasaq. Although I always defer to Bernadette Elvana Stimpfel. You can Google her master's thesis, and she's got a really good source on spelling and proper use of words. Also, Larry Kaplan is one of the few speakers that can speak and write the King Island dialect.
And Bruce joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruce.
Thanks, Steve. Joan, really familiar with your work and big admirer of it and familiar with your career. And so I know how gifted you are, and I mean no disrespect at all when I say artists aren't known for their ability to estimate the cost of large-scale projects. So I just want to say to the listeners out there, even though Joan has made her goal on her U.S. artist crowdfunding platform, she's probably wrong on how much money she actually needs to do this. So I want to encourage people to continue to make contributions to that, because my experience is that artists always underestimate the cost of things that they want to do. And so don't let that goal blind you to the realities of the scale and complexity of this project. And I just want to congratulate you, Joan. Way to go.
Thanks, Bruce. And, you know, I had an email from another guy whose family is distantly originally from Nome, and he sent me a message on Facebook, and he said, you need at least $200,000.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I thought, well, thanks for your input. maybe we should chat this next week. And I haven't had a chance to get back to him, but $200,000. I have relatives Bruce.
My message isn't to you. It's okay. To everybody listening to this show. You know, I mean, well, of course, my heart and hopes go out for you. But I just want people to really think about that. It's an amazing undertaking. And when I first saw it go up on the site, I was thinking, "Ooh."
Well, what site is that? We haven't even plugged the site.
U.S. Artists. They operate. They're a national consortium of arts funders, and it's a whole group of philanthropic foundations from around the country who've created this fund. And they do several things, but one of them is they make available their crowdfunding platform to artists that qualify. And of course, Joan qualified easily. There's, you know, a number of criteria, but it's like Kickstarter, but it's much more focused and much more specific to gathering donors' interest and donations for art projects specifically, it's not as broad as, say, Indiegogo or Kickstarter, but it's a really, really good site because it allows artists to get matching funds from some of these philanthropic foundations, and it also, they don't take any overhead as of just recently. They don't take a cut, which, of course, all the other sites do.
And thanks, Bruce, as well, for pointing out that the site is still available for donations. I'm just amazed at the people that continue to give to the project and very grateful. And, yeah, I think they're still accepting donations for another 30 days, so you can go to U.S. Artists and USA Projects and find the project and donate if you are so moved.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce, for your call. Bruce is gone. Let's go to Bill in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Bill.
How's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to ask Joan about her poem, King Island, and how it relates to the project that she is doing, and I'll read a little bit of it. A line of white birds ends in nothing. The falling song of women unseen twists between rock spires. Our distant island haunted by the numberless. From the deep shade of the gully, the water continues to rise, unbound from the slum that backs to black bogs, surrounded by gravel, take us back.
Thank you, Bill. That poem is from a book that will be out from the University of Pittsburgh Press in November. So you must have seen Layli Long Soldier did a tremendous compilation of women writers for the journal Drunken Boat. And Layli is someone who, as an artist and as a mother, and as a traditional person, I really, really, and also as someone who's totally punk rock, I really look up to her. And I think she selected that poem. This poem in particular refers to the specific geography of King Island. The rock spires, the granitic tors on top of the island, our distant island haunted by the numberless. You know, it's uninhabited now. So there are numberless people who no longer live there. And I think the other thing, the penultimate stanza, kind of gets at some of the socioeconomic conditions that certainly I was raised in, and that my relatives continue to be raised in. I grew up, people joke with me, I say, Muldoon Miu Hurunga. I'm a person from Muldoon. And, you know, I think that last stanza, penultimate stanza, talks about some of the places that we were relocated to and the places where we have experienced our lives and grown. So as far as a quick gloss of that poem, I hope that helps. And the line of white birds ends in nothing. Most of my uncles are ivory carvers, and I didn't mean to say that their line of carvings ends in nothing. But you see this market where, you know, tremendously talented ivory carvers are carving earrings for sale, and that's how they make their living. And
it's what sells.
It's what sells, but it's also, you know, if you were to look at all the carvings, little swan carvings that my uncles have done, I mean, it would be an amazing art installation project just to gather small ivory carvings and put them in one place. But
Bill, thank you so much for reading the poem.
No, awesome. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. And Dave joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. What a fascinating journey. I really appreciate hearing this. Such a wonderful biography, autobiography. I just wanted to mention how fascinating I find King Island. Only been out there once. We went out just to look. We left Nome, and it was a 75-degree day, sunny, and got out there towards the afternoon, and it was just stunning and spiritual is all I can say, even for me. And as she mentioned, the tours are just magnificent on top, and the current that runs down off the southwest cape is just full of sea life boiling up. Right there, as we turned around the corner, the weather came in real fast, almost as if an omen. But it was just a spiritual reverie to actually spend a little time even offshore there. And I sure hope you enjoy your time there. I know you will.
Thank you so much.
Dave, thank you so much for sharing that. So he's been there. And you get to go there.
Well, and hearing those vivid images, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I've heard about my whole life. And just in that same register.
Yeah. Sue says, how are you gonna pick who goes with you? Well, I think she wants to go.
Sue, is that my Auntie Sue?
Could
Sue
be.
Tolliver? I talked to you last week at A&B in Nome. you know, I've been so busy with work that I'm still...
Time's up.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks to Dave Waldron. Sarah Bernard.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The University of Alaska Southeast has web-based bachelor degree programs for first-time and transfer students. Learn online and work closely with advisors and experts in subjects like history, psychology, and anthropology. Cutting-edge technology prepares students for a variety of career paths, including graduate programs in teaching, counseling, and law. For more information, call Gail Klein at 228-4508. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.